welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by Scale Up Consulting, helping FinTech startups create a scalable organization to support an ever-increasing demand. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@scaleupconsulting.co. Now, over to the show with Richard Doherty, founder and host.
Hey, what's up, everyone? And welcome back to another episode of the FinTech Scaling Show, where we talk to founders and evangelists and really get the insights on how they scale up their business and also at the same time scale up their lives. And really stoked today to get Casey on the show. Casey is the CEO and the founder of Skeleton. He is also a pro golfer, so awesome to have a pro golfer, first pro golfer on the show. So awesome to have you on the show. And prior to that, you know, Casey has also run and founded a couple of other ventures. So he's got really great experience into how to build and also scale up companies. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Richard. I appreciate it.
Cool. Listen, before we get into the nuts and the bolts of today's session, I just want to give everyone a bit of an overview of what we're going to be chatting about today. Casey and myself were chatting over the last few weeks and really diving into what we could bring you guys as a really unique way of starting off 2022. And we sort of were scratching our heads and doing some brainstorming. So there's some logic to what comes out of today's session. And we came up with this. We could go into tech and all the cool things that Casey is developing, but we came up with how to really leverage the metaverse as you build out your organizational structure. So something that we have chatted about before, i.e. organizational structure, but now we're bringing in a totally different angle to this. So super excited to jump into this today, Casey, and let's kick it off, right? Traditionally, in the traditional sense, organizations, they grow up, they have roles, they have departments. With inside those departments, they have heads of departments. With inside those departments and those heads of departments, you have employees. And, you know, this is sort of the engine room of where productivity happens. And what I want to know from you straight off is that traditional way of thinking of an organizational structure, how is that different to what you are looking at doing at Skeleton and how you're looking at building out your organizational structure?
Yeah, that's a really good question. One thing that I noticed in big tech is that a lot of the internal organizational structure of companies are still being founded today. It's based on a 20th century model that I think is outdated. And it's outdated depending on your industry. Specifically for fintech, I think that there's so much technology out there that's available right now that you can kind of restructure your organization, not just for the sake of doing it, but to achieve your goals in a more robust, convex, scalable way. And that's kind of why I orchestrated the internal structure of my company the way that I did.
Just give us a second there, mate. But restructuring, right? And I know we're going to go into the rest of your answer, but restructuring in and on itself is actually quite a big, it's a challenge that companies go through because they are taking on more employees, they're taking on more clients, they feel the need to restructure. And that takes time and that takes effort and also costs money to restructure, right? And in this vein, how different is the structure that we're going to talk about when it's fully fledged? How much restructuring do we actually have to go through?
Well, the whole reason why I built my company the way that I did was so that if we do have to make adjustments in the future, it will be way easier to do it. So like, again, the whole point of the way that I built the company is to make it set up so that it can scale as fast as possible to mitigate the exact problems that you just described, right? Yeah. So like, if we run into a situation where we have to add more infrastructure or we're going to add a new feature or something, we have to hire people for that. I wanted to set up the company in a way that all of that could happen mostly autonomously, to be honest with you. And I can explain if you want what the structure looks like, just so
I know I interrupted you there. I just wanted to look at the restructuring part of it because it is quite a, you know, I see it all the time with my clients. clients go through restructuring. It takes so much effort and so much time, effort, and also money. And if there's an alternative route, let's obviously discuss. But yeah, what does that structure look like?
So traditional company, you would have boots on the ground people, mid-level management, directors, VPs, C-suite, and then board and investors and stuff, right? And there's a whole bunch of problems with that, both the economics of tech startups. My company was in an accelerator program that we graduated from, and I learned a lot about just the economics of how the money moves around in tech startups. Yeah. And combining like that knowledge with understanding how blockchain and a lot of crypto Web3 stuff works, I wanted to kind of take a new business model with my product, not only a new business model, but a new organizational structure, and bring it to my company to solve for a lot of the problems that I'm seeing occurring in tech startups and funding and that whole economy and how it works, because it's not advantageous. If you're a founder and you want to build a great company, the economics of how funding works for startups right now is not advantageous. So what it looks like for me is it's about like setting a goal, and then how do I structure our company and our workflow and our product and our relationship with our customer such that we achieve that goal as fast as possible, and there wouldn't be any bottleneck in terms of how fat and in terms of the ability to scale. So like all the problems you're outlining, those are problems that where the internal structure of the company becomes its own bottleneck, right? Like you don't want to be the bottleneck to your own success. You want to have things set up from the beginning such that it can expand forever and not be a bottleneck. And so if you're familiar with DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations, it's something that's getting really popular in Web3 right now. And the thing that I recognize with that technology, and it's brilliant technology, the concept of it is brilliant. But the problem with it is there's no utility function to a lot of the companies that are building those, meaning that the average person has no idea what that is, and they have no idea how it could benefit them.
Yeah.
But my company is building a product that the average person will use, and it's something that makes sense to them, and it solves a very practical problem. And so because of that, I can sell them my product, but internally, my organizational structure is leveraging all this new technology that the user doesn't even have to know about, right? Like if you went to my website or if you became a user of my company, you would have no idea that we're structured in this way. We would just look like any other fintech product on the surface, more or less. Mm-hmm. And you're just using us because we're solving a problem for you. But internally, our organizational structure is built to scale very, very fast. Mm-hmm. So what that looks like is, we have our founding team, and our founding team makes all of our decisions about like product, marketing, new versions, new iterations, everything. Everything that the company does comes from our own internal team. And then instead of having different project managers and different departments and a whole gambit of employees, we set up a tiered system where we have contract workers. And we splice up kind of the work across freelance teams that we outsource to. Mm-hmm. And then we have another layer of crowdsourced work. So everything that our company requires in order to scale, we go directly to our user who's already using the product. And we basically make it available to them that if they have certain skills that would benefit us, they can start working for us immediately. And then that work, whatever work it is that they're doing, whether it's coding or marketing or support or anything like that, we're crowdsourcing for that. And then their work would get funneled into layer two, which is the freelance team. And then that work would get funneled into the founding team, essentially. So the reason why that's structured in that way, the reason why that's important is, number one, it solves for a lot of problems in the way businesses used to do things, right? Where it eliminates guesswork. So if I'm going to market a product, I need to do, like, think about everything that goes into marketing a product. You have to do the branding, you have to create advertising, you have to figure out what the sales pitch is, all that stuff. Instead of me hiring someone who has like 20 years of experience in marketing and sales and whatever, and having them come up with some idea, and then you're just basically blindfolded, throwing a dart against the wall, hoping you hit the bullseye, right? instead of hiring one person with that skill set, they might be successful. It might take them a long time to figure that out, though. But if I just go directly to the user who's already using the product and they already know the product, and if the product is as good as I know that it is, they're going to already be telling other people about it. And so why not like make it available for them to make money off of that? So that's what I did. It's like, so if you have graphic design skills, for instance, and you're a user of our company, you can create marketing material and submit it to us. And that marketing material goes through that funnel that I was explaining of the different layers. And basically what it is it turns into a smart contract, and then we run the advertising, and depending on how the ad performs, the user automatically gets reimbursed. So as a payment solution, we're optimizing rewards. We're basically, we're saving the customer money and then making them a little bit of extra money on top of that. But then we're also giving them the opportunity to leverage their existing skill set to make even more money. So my ultimate goal with that would be is to have as many of my users making a living off of submitting their skills, essentially, to growing our company. So it becomes a feedback loop, essentially, where the people who are using the product are also helping the product grow. And this actually, like if you take a 50,000 foot view, first principle thinking around this, the basics of it is a totally different economic system. It's kind of like an efficient non-zero sum version of capitalism, where my goal with everything is how can I create a system from the very beginning that will benefit the user, will benefit the employee, will benefit the founder, will benefit the company itself, benefit the investor. So there's a lot of people there that all have different incentives and different reasons for wanting to interact and engage in the marketplace with my product. And I'm trying to create a system that will benefit all of those people in a non-zero-sum way, where no one has to lose in order for someone else to win, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. So get the system, but how do you get this off the ground, right? So I'm thinking early stage startup, they're interested in a system like this. They can obviously leverage the freelance market, because that's there. It's always been there. But if you're MVP and you don't have users, and you or MVP or beta, you don't have users, you sort of pre-launch, how are you going to be, what's the route to get these users involved in that activity that you just described?
Well, there's a whole bunch of different ways. Do you want me to answer the question from like what I'm specifically going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so acquiring users is not very difficult. It's all social media based marketing. The whole product is kind of leveraging social media, advertising, branding, content production. So figuring out that can, you know, we can extrapolate the process of like figuring out where our target market is and getting directly to our target user. So that's where it starts, is with social media and content production, and then also piggybacking off of other companies' audiences. So there's a whole bunch of different companies in our space that we are developing B2B relationships with. So being able to get to their users as well, and also integrating with like, say, APIs and stuff, and being able to get data on their users. And that would make us more efficient in terms of finding our users and targeting them. So things like that. And then like once we get with an initial user base scaling, because of the nature of the way I was explaining the way the company is set up, the scalability is quite limitless.
And who in your organizational structure, who leads that? Is it the founders? Is it a, for want of a better word, a sort of a chief marketing officer or chief revenue officer? Who owns that process to go out, build those relationships, plug into different social media platforms, get the ads going, and get the users initially engaged, and obviously then filtering into the next part of it, which is content creation?
You're looking at...
Yeah, I thought so.
It does. I wear all of those hats. I do have an internal marketing team that I work closely with, but it's mostly just generated from me and then my other co-founders.
But if you take, you know, so now I know you guys are starting out and we sort of pre-launch, right? So if we move forward to a year's time where we've got a lot of users on, we've got a buzzing ecosystem, is it prudent to take off some of those hats that you're wearing and give the CRO hat or the CMO hat, or whatever you want to call it, to a person? So this person runs and manages that sort of universe. And then you are in the founders, you'll be in the founders universe or whatever it is that you do. I mean, is that how you're thinking, or is it very much exactly as you described earlier, where there's very limited sort of hierarchical or very limited resources at the top and very much directed through the user group that you obviously are going to be managing?
All of my decisions, and that's a good question. All my decisions will be based around mitigating bureaucracy as much as possible.
Yeah.
So that's the advantage of being a startup in the first place, is you can be on the cutting edge of innovation and you can be extremely dynamic and you can move really quickly and really, you're so flexible. Like Google can't. Apple actually, I would say Apple's internal structure is probably the best one out of all the big tech companies, because they have all these little teams that function like mini startups for all their projects. I think that's cool.
Yeah.
But again, it depends on what you're building. But to answer your question, I see all my decisions as being like, how do I retain as much of a robust, dynamic, fast-paced organization as possible? And then whatever that decision is the decision I'm going to be making. Mm. So if I need to have a manager oversee a certain project so that it can take time off of my hands so I can allocate my time more efficiently, that would definitely be something that I plan on doing.
Yeah.
But really what it is it's more like, there might be a manager that's on a specific project, but how, like, I want to set the organizational structure should be designed so that his decision-making and his job has as much automation incorporated into it as possible.
Yeah.
So when it comes to a marketing campaign, he doesn't have to hire a graphic designer. He's got 1,200 graphic designers because the users are submitting the material, and then we can run testing and stuff like that to decide which ads are the right ones to run. Mm-hmm. So that's, like, again, the advantage of using a lot of this Web3 tech, where we can just basically be more efficient and more optimized with our decision making.
Yeah, but it also sounds like using the tech, using freelancers, you also ultimately creating a self-organized ecosystem here where this, let's call it marketing, where marketing can function by itself. It's maybe a team of two or three internally, but then externally, as you say, there's 12,000 or 15,000, whatever the number is, right? Yeah. And if you look at PR as an example, it might be similar. And all these self-organized teams are organizing themselves, which gives you, as a founder, the opportunity to do other things, maybe create different products or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, you answered, you articulated everything correctly. That is exactly how I'm thinking about it.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So how do you, as you move through this self-organization and also then leveraging Web3 and freelancers and, you know, ultimately the new way of engaging talents out there, how do you make certain that there is a level of, that you retain a level of control about how you are branded in sort of that, your ecosystem, and how people perceive your content and your message? Or is that even necessary?
Man, that's difficult because, well, you can control the initial branding, but as far as, like, every company deals with the problem of public perception to some extent. Yeah. And it's more of like just the cognitive dissonance between the public engaging with what's being said about the company and then not understanding what's happening internally in the organization. Yeah. And that's, I'm really trying to build a company that would, I'm trying to solve as much of that in the beginning as I can.
Yeah.
But at some point, when you scale to a certain size, a lot of things are out of control. And you can't control essentially the media message. You can only control, like, what you're personally putting out and what you're personally saying. Mm. But I think that the best PR would just be, is if you're as authentic and open and honest as possible, people respond to that differently than if they think that you're being conniving or if you're trying to hide something from them. which is the problem with Facebook right now. Like, they have a lot of really bad PR that I think could have been mitigated if they were just more upfront with their user. Where I look at a good example was when the iPhone 4 came out, there was an issue with the antenna, and something was malfunctioning with the phone. Yeah. And Steve Jobs had to do a really quick like PR conference. He had to fly out of vacation or something like that. And he did a PR conference and he said, listen, you know, it's technology. Sometimes things don't work. And, you know, it's like, we're sorry, we didn't build it right. Anyone that has a problem with their phone can submit it back to us and we'll give you a new one for free. And we're just going to try and build a new version that's better. Mm-hmm. And everyone was like, okay. And I thought that that was the right way to handle that. And I think that if you're trying to navigate the waters of branding and marketing, just trying to be position yourself as being as authentic and honest as possible. And if you set that precedent up front, then people will deal with you differently and they'll respond to you differently and they'll think of you differently. So I don't know if that answered your question.
I love it. I think you hit the nail on the head there. And if you take that, you know, sort of one step further, I think also as you engage in with your public, your users in this instance, who are not only using your platform, but also being, ultimately, they're being advocates, right? If you're creating content for a platform, you're an advocate of that platform. That communication line to those users, how are you using that communication line? How are you making certain that if a user, let's call him Richard, if Richard is keen to write a bit of content or shoot a video about Skeleton, how do you make certain that I have the right information at my fingertips to create the content that I want to create? Or is that something you don't have to worry about, which is back to your first point around not worrying about certain things as you scale up?
Well, think about it like this. So just to use your example, if you're going to make content that would become a marketing promotional material for my company, you're incentivized to do that because you know that if you make really good content and that content continues to promote our company and grow our company, you're going to get reimbursed for that. And it's, again, like, this is all on the blockchain. Like, once a smart contract is generated, it can't be undone. And there's nothing that I can do to change that. So whatever amount of money that you would generate from the success of your content is going to get to you guaranteed. So it's basically, think of it like this. If you know that it's you and thousands of other people that are going to be generating content, you're competing against them. So I'm creating an economic system where you are incentivized to make the best content that will spread as much as possible, that's better than other people's. So I'm orchestrating that, the economics of it, from the beginning. So you're in competition with other users to make better content, then you're going to make more money. Okay. Then for me, it's my job to make you understand that and make as clear of a message as possible so that you understand. So I set you up to be as successful as possible, right? Okay. So that would come from me and my team personally generating as much content, explaining that and showing how the technology works. And honestly, I'm probably not going to be as heavy hitting on advertising that component of the company just because I want people to kind of go looking for that. And I think that that would be a good way to approach it in the beginning, because I can always run ads. Like, I can change that plan later on. But I want the users who, like, a user who is just on the surface level using the product because it solves a problem for them, fine. But a user who gets into our ecosystem and starts going through our web app or our mobile app and notices that there's other features in there. And it's kind of like that process of self-discovery where the user sees, oh, wait a second, I can submit like my skill set to this company and make money off of it and get reimbursed in a smart contract. That's pretty cool. And I want those people to kind of like find it. So that's how I'm thinking about it initially.
Okay. I love it. And as you build that function out, because it is, we're talking about marketing here, this marketing, PR, let's just sort of stay there for a second, because I know there's, we've spoken off air about support and other parts, but marketing, PR, and that world branding, as a business, you do need to get your name out there, right? It's not, you can't just sit in the corner and hope for users or people to find you. You need to get your name out there. So can you give examples of maybe some other companies out there that have used similar sort of this tech to really increase the productivity of their marketing campaigns and also their visibility into their ecosystem?
Yeah. So there are examples of other companies that have done things that have certain components of things that I'm doing. Not everything that I'm building is completely novel. It's only that I'm stitching a lot of components that already exist in some fashion into a product that is extremely practical that the average person can use, which is something that doesn't really exist in crypto at all. So we were talking about the Robinhood one. So I liked that example just because it was such a simple shift that it, like, increase the amount of money on their platform, the investment amount on their platform, like, exponentially. So what Robinhood did was they initially started out not as a trading application, but like a interface to like portfolio management stuff. And when they started enabling trading, they noticed that because their target users are people that are not, that previously were not in the, in the stock market. So they were not a disrupting product, they were a market expanding product because they weren't in competition with like Fidelity or other trading platform. They were targeting a new user, which were millennials and Gen Z. But the problem was is that millennials and Gen Z were investing on the platform in companies that they already knew something about. And they were not expanding their investment portfolio to other types of companies. So what Robinhood did was they'd made a really simple user interface change where when you opened up the app, the first thing that you would see would be a newsfeed. And they just restructured the newsfeed so that you were getting news about companies that were in other industries, but were similar enough to your current investments that you would start to look into those other companies that were in industries that were outside of where your current portfolio was in. So they started generating a whole bunch of investment in all these other industries, or the user would rather. And the amount of money that came flooding into their platform, it was like that one simple user interface change could explain a lot of their massive growth. And now they're the biggest firm broker, essentially, in the United States. I like that example because it was something that was so trivial and so simple to do that like probably one of their lead UI UX guys probably could have done that in a weekend. And yet it resulted in probably billions and billions of dollars of revenue for them.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant example. And, you know, I guess right now we've discussed the organizational structure, the traditional org structure. We've also looked at a new world using Web3 communities and freelancers, self-organization. Then we got into a bit of an example about, actually a very good example about sort of the Robin Hood example and how they leverage this data and this tech to grow exponentially. And just taking another step into the organizational structure and organizational charts. I mean, inside organizations, there's always a need to consistently communicate, whether you are a team of five, whether you're a team of 10, whatever the team size is, you always have to communicate, right? Whatever the structure is as well, you always have to communicate, whether you're self-organized or a traditional player, it doesn't matter. You've got to communicate. And in this world that we're talking about right now, this world leveraging all these different bits of tech and also the self-organization that you're referring to, how do you make certain that you're always in sync with your internal teams? And likewise, your internal team is always in sync with, you know, the founders and the executives in the business.
Are you talking about like the communication workflow and everything?
Yeah, exactly.
So I really, really like Basecamp, and the CEO of Basecamp, Jason Fried, is really, really interesting to me. He's really a cool guy. They have on their website, they've got a whole kind of communicational process, an internal communicational process that they just give away for free. I follow that almost to a T, and like everyone that I work with is on that model. And so we're only working with people that have, it's all remote driven. So being able to be a really good writer and communicate with the written word is extremely important. And all of those principles of mitigating meetings as much as possible, because meetings waste time. And so I really like Basecamp, and I try to follow their communicational principles as much as possible. So anyone who is struggling with internal communication, I would go to Basecamp as like the number one resource. Another example is Zapier. If you're familiar with Zapier automation tool, they have a forum on their site that also talks about their internal communication, because the whole company is based around automation. Like, that's their product, is like automating internet web services.
Yeah.
So you would think that they would want to build, like, they use their own product in order to automate a lot of their workflow.
Yeah.
And like GitHub uses GitHub to run GitHub, like that kind of stuff. So those companies, I think, have a lot of the internal communication figured out. But yeah, Basecamp is my favorite by far.
Nice, nice. And comms aside, there's also every organization, whether you're using the sort of the new funky stuff or the traditional stuff, you also have to know what your problem or challenge areas are, and also where you aren't challenging, where you're growing or exceeding. So what I like to look at is, you need to know whether you are expanding or contracting, right? You as a CEO, founder, and the executive team, the investors, they all need to know whether it's growing, whether it's not. If it's not growing, if you're contracting, you really need to sort of know why you're contracting and then be able to solve the problem. So in this model, in this structure that we're talking about, how do you get sufficient data at your fingertips that says, yeah, cool, we are expanding in this area, maybe this department, let's call it the business development department, but in maybe the product department, we are contracting because we haven't had such good releases over the last couple of releases. So I'm curious to find out how you gather that data using this structure.
Yeah, that's a good question. So in terms of using data to make decisions, I think that like the whole essence of building a decentralized autonomous organization is that it's self-propagating. So if the organization isn't expanding, then it's not meeting the needs of whoever it's supposed to meet the needs for.
Okay.
So the product itself should be inherently solving a problem. So I would say that for me, if it's structured, if everything is built correctly and all the incentives are there and everything about the organization is set up correctly, if it's not growing, then it's just not resonating with the user. And so that is a fundamental problem with the product design.
Yeah.
So I like to think of, I mean, I already used Steve Jobs as an example. I respect the guy so much. I think that the way his thinking about things was pretty much spot on in terms of like, build the best possible product that you can build. And that solves a lot of the problems that you're talking about from the beginning. Yeah. So if you just focus on building the best thing you can build, but there's a component to that, right? That I think a lot of people miss in the tech space. And I think that people who come from traditional finance have more of that figured out. It's just that they lack the technical knowledge to leverage fintech correctly. But for anyone who's in fintech, if you're building a product that is targeted at solving a specific problem for your users, just make the best possible product that you can build.
Yeah.
And if it's not working, it's because of one of two things. Either the product isn't as good as it could be, meaning that there's other things out there that the user would rather use than your product, or your messaging isn't really resonating. So there's something there that you're doing wrong, where you build something, you put it out into the world, and either people want to use it because they see some benefit for it or they don't.
Yeah.
And so if it's the best thing that you could possibly build, but it's not growing, then maybe your messaging about it is wrong. Like you just have to get into the user's head and see how they're interacting with the product.
Yeah.
And honestly, like in the crypto Web3 community, I see a lot of, it's not like they're building the best stuff on the planet right now, but it's not resonating with the average person because there's such a gap there of education. There's an educational gap, and the people in Web3 don't know how to market to the average person. They're mostly building stuff for each other. And it's not just like, I mean, you can draw examples from other industries too.
Yeah.
But that would be like the fundamental crux. So just build the best possible product that you can.
Yep.
And if everything is structured correctly and the messaging is structured correctly, it should self-propagate.
Hmm. Yeah. So it's interesting, right? Because looking at just the product and the message, and I get it, I don't disagree, but is that from a growth or contraction point of view, is that all we need to look at? Why I say that is if you, for whatever reason, let's take this example of leveraging different communities, different styles of structure. If you have a great product and if you have a great message, but your structures internally are holding you back for whatever reason, as a CEO, as a founder, you need to fucking know about that, right? You need to you need to figure it out. Otherwise, it's going to be your whatever on the block, right? there's no two ways about it, right? Yeah. So you got to shovel in the dough, or you're not going to be able to sit in that position for a lot of time. So I want to know that if I use this new structure, that I'm able to solve those, I'm able to get to those problems quicker. If I can get to them quicker and solve for them quicker, right? Because I know there's always new and innovative ways to do things. I get it. I know that. I also know that I can get data through those old and traditional ways. If a team is underperforming, you can see it a mile off, and that's going to come up as a red flag in my executive committee and or my executive meeting, and we're going to go down there and we're going to help that team. But in this model, I'm on the fence as to how I can get... I know the whole self-propagating, and I know the message, and I know the product, but I'm on the fence as to how I can get that data to really solve the problems internally in my business that allow us to spread our wings, right? I don't know if you can shed any light on that. I know you mentioned there's a couple of examples out there like PayPal and Robinhood and others. Can you bring in a bit of color on this subject?
Yeah. So PayPal, for instance, it was founded in the late 90s, and their organizational structure is based on a 20th century model, right? Like they've got thousands of employees and they have a whole bunch of different departments, and it's very corporate-y and it's very bureaucratic, and they're building stuff. Like I know developers over there, they're building stuff in crypto right now. And it's really hard to make a general answer to your question.
But a
company like that is just trying to maximize, like they're just trying to do what they did last quarter. It's at 0.03% better, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So they're more like a bank than anything. And they're just trying to retain as many users in their funnel as possible. So their goals are different than a really small, robust startup like mine. But there's nothing that they are doing that they like, there's nothing about their they have all these resources. They're a huge asset. They have, you know, they could get the best talent in the world if they wanted it. There's nothing about them that they can't do what I'm doing. It's just that they aren't, and they're not incentivized to, but I could explain how they could probably bridge that gap.
Yeah. I mean, listen, because again, we're talking about traditional and the new world and the new organizational structure. So, you know, how can, and I think everyone out there wants to know if they want to bridge that gap, if they want to try something new, if they want to try a new organizational structure, how can they do it? How can you move from on a cake or a 20th century model to one that actually is going to be scalable as we enter into 2022 and beyond?
I think that a lot of it is just trying to extrapolate out as far as you possibly can from the beginning. So it's just like, what does the end game look like? Like if you're going to learn chess, you start by learning the end game and getting good at that first, and then you work backwards to openings. Yeah. So it's the same thing with business, where it's like, well, what are your long-term goals? You want to build a company that is a small business, or do you want to build a billion-dollar unicorn or something in between that? Or maybe you don't have answers to those questions, and that's fine, but you should think through as much of that as possible, to the point where I think that it's just really, it's like people will set initial goal of like, I want to get funding, I want to build this product, I want to do this thing. And then they are so obsessed or hyper fixating on just getting like through the initial steps that they don't really think about like, what does it look like after I get over those milestones and after I achieve, like once I'm successful, then what? Right. And I think that it's important to think about that as much as possible so that you know where you're going toward, like, you know what you're working towards. So I think that that comes down to like goal setting. But if you want to build an organization that is like mine, it's actually, there's a lot of technology that's out there that's already available that can honestly help do that. And I'd be happy to, you know, send you some links if you want to put it in the show notes or whatever. But in terms of building a DAO, decentralized autonomous organization, there's a company called Algorand, I think.
Yeah.
I was just looking at them recently, but they build forkable DAOs. So they have basically the infrastructure already built, and then you can fork it and make it into whatever you want. So that's something that people could look into. And again, I think it really comes down to, like, if you're a fintech company, you're solving some problem in finance that didn't exist before. Yeah. And so it really comes down to like working backwards from that. So like if you're solving some specific problem, whether it's B2C or B2B, understanding your product and then understanding like, how do I scale this product? And then think through that process as much as possible and then build your organizational structure from that, right? Yeah. Where I think that the old way of doing things was top down. Yeah. Where it was like, we're going to build an organizational structure and then we're going to jam it into the marketplace and try, and we're going to jam it into our product and our problem. Where I think it's like, focus on the problem and what the product solution is to it. And then however that would go about scaling in the market, build your organizational structure around that. Yeah. And that would be a bottom up process. And I think that that's just, it's a lot of it is just the way you think about it and mindset related things, I think.
Yeah. I like it. Yeah, definitely. I love it. And listen, as you wrap up this part of the show, are there any other final thoughts on organizational structures and how listeners out there can leverage this new way of thinking?
Yeah. So I think that like if you take a 50,000 foot view of fintech, every fintech company is more or less the bank on the back end. And so I was talking about PayPal. I'll give you an example with PayPal. So what PayPal does and how PayPal functions are two different things, and the user doesn't know that. And I bet that a lot of the people that work at the company don't even know that. But more or less, every fintech company is kind of based on this example. So with PayPal, for instance, when you use PayPal, you think that you're sending money from your email address to your friend's email address, but that's not how the company works. Yeah. You're actually sending money to PayPal, and then PayPal is sending that money to the other person. And it sounds like a trivial difference, but on the back end, with like the way the whole software is structured, it's not. Yeah. So what happens is every user of PayPal has their bank account connected to PayPal.
Yeah.
On PayPal's end, all of those user bank accounts are funneled into one corporate bank account that they have. That's basically like a giant slush fund. So that makes them a bank, right? Because if everyone's money is going into one account, that means that there's supply and demand. Like there's flow of money coming in and out of that account. That's exactly what a bank does, is borrowing and lending. So they can leverage that asset to do other stuff.
Yeah.
And the only difference between them and a bank is that they have this digital interface that people are using to solve some problem, which the problem for them is ease of sending money to friends, P2P, right?
Yeah.
And basically every fintech company does some version of that. So every fintech company is a bank, and every fintech company's product is money. Yeah. And if you think about it like that, then it kind of lets you explore new ideas for how you would structure a company and how your business model would, like how you maneuver money and stuff like that. So I started, when I got into fintech, I started with looking at it from that perspective and then trying to see how the innovation, where the industry could go from there. And that's where I came up with building the organization the way that I did, so that it has, you know, just limitless scalability.
Cool. Yeah, great example to end off this part of the show. And now we head into the flash round. The flash round is a bit of fun at the end of the show. We get to know a bit more about Casey. And, you know, then Casey takes over the mic and asks me a question, one question only. I know some people are a bit cheeky and they ask me three or four, but one today. But let's have a bit of fun and let's kick it off. So first question for you, Casey. Okay, so are you an investor or are you a business builder?
I'm both. I also run a crypto fund. So I actively manage money and I invest money both in crypto and in traditional markets. But I would say I'm primarily an entrepreneur and a product-driven entrepreneur, B2C entrepreneur. Yeah. That's where my bread and butter skill set is. But I do think of myself as both of those things.
Cool. Okay. Golf courses or computers?
Golf courses.
Obviously. Come on, Richard. Okay. So this is the tricky one. Tom Watson's swing or Tiger's swing?
Tiger, for sure.
Okay, there we go. I was going to go with Tom Watson, but there we go. Okay, I'm going to flip it around and give you the mic. And do you have a question for me?
Well, I'd like to ask you something that would be a unique insight from your perspective. So you're in the UK, right?
Yeah. I'm in London.
Okay. Yeah. That's right. So what would you say, are you seeing anything in like the global financial markets based on like your relationships through this show or through your network or your company, your skill set? What is there anything that you see happening in the global markets that you think is unique to from your perspective versus like say my perspective in the US or something like that?
Global markets. I mean, that's so listen, I think in the UK, it is a bit unique right now in the fact that our market is, in a way, I don't want to say shrinking, but it's slightly different, right? With Brexit. And Brexit is a bit of a pain that we've all had to go through. But what I would say, although there is Brexit and all that's going on, I think the massive opportunity that is lying at people's feet, and maybe they don't see, not for not wanting to see, but they don't look at it, maybe like I look at it, maybe like you look at it, is something that allows businesses and entrepreneurs to always be cross-border. And it's now diverging into what we call the metaverse, where we started discussing today, but traditionally was the internet. Yeah. And also the use of social media. So there is a big opportunity. Even if you're starting out now, even if you're a corporate, even if you're depending on where you are in your journey, if you want to dive deep into business and don't worry about the shenanigans that are all the headlines, I think if you double down on really getting your knowledge up on how to use the internet, how to use social media, and also how to start playing in this world, in this metaverse world, which dovetails into what you're doing around crypto, NFTs, etc., there is boundless opportunity. And when I mean boundless, there's no location. You can be wherever you want to be. You just have to be curious. Right.
Can I ask you a little quick follow-up on that? Because I was thinking of this as you're talking. Are you seeing any crypto blockchain-based companies doing any moving towards traditional finance at all, like in specifically in the UK or in Europe? Because in the United States, we have a booming blockchain crypto industry, but I don't see any of them trying to do anything with like the traditional banking system or with traditional markets. I see them kind of going away from them. Yeah. But I was just seeing there's a blockchain company called Elrond that I really like, and they just got an ETF listed on the German stock exchange. So are you seeing anything?
I am seeing, there is definitely a bit of noise around crypto entering into the new digital currencies, entering into the traditional finance houses. There is noise. I don't know whether that's just noise or whether it's going to play out as something that is going to be taken on with renewed vigor in the coming year, right? So there was definitely noise, 6 months worth of chatter in sort of different financial service sectors or bodies last year. I think it resulted in what you just mentioned. There's others as well that also been taking on different types of assets into their portfolios. So yes, let's see how it plays out this year. That's what I'd say. But you know, if you look further ahead,
are more open to it, exploring it.
I think so. Yeah. If you look for, I mean, I think yeah, right. If you look further ahead, as to you know what I mentioned earlier on, traditional banks have to. They have to be involved in the new digital economy. If they aren't, then fintechs and the like will take that space, right? And we've already seen challenger banks in the UK like Revolut and what have you take up a large slice of the market. And now obviously Revolut's out in the US. So the same thing is going to happen from a crypto side of things. If the big banks don't want to invest in that space, then there'll be an uprise of other institutions that do want to because they see that, right? So I think this is there definitely is a movement in the UK and Europe, but it will take the next year or so to see how that moves along.
Do you feel like the citizens are driving that at all, like pushing it to, or is it just like an internal banking decision because of the nature of the industry?
What do you mean the citizens, as in
the customers, like the market, right? Like, is there like a lot of growth or like are a lot of people in the UK going into crypto, moving money into crypto?
Listen, I think there's more appetite. There definitely is more appetite, but there's huge knowledge gap in what this is and how you can actually leverage it. And then the platforms are quite young in a way. They don't have the brand power of a JP Morgan or a Deutsche Bank. So users going into this world, if they're not, for example, me, who is lucky enough to interview guys like, have chats with guys like you and also other sort of crypto entrepreneurs, there's a whole trust factor around it, right? So it takes them a bit longer to get up that curve.
Yeah.
And saying that, there's also, I guess, the target market, the age differentiation is slightly different, right? I think younger generations, I know younger generations are obviously very much into crypto world, whereas guys in their 40s, 50s, 60s, I mean, they've missed the boat on that in a way. So they're trying to get educated. Yeah. So it's a difficult question to be like, to give you an ABC answer. I think from the top, there is definitely much more news about it. There's definitely a lot of investment activity in and around this space. There's definitely more people starting to invest in it. And there's also more asset managers and wealth managers that are looking at ways of bringing this type of investment opportunity into their portfolios. So it all plays out as a market that is only going to get stronger, in my view, right?
Mm. Okay. Well, that's my two cents. News then for people like us and other companies.
you can see it. I mean, if you take a look at the likes of in the UK and Europe anyway, the likes of Swissborg, the Swissborg raised some really good capital last year and they're growing. You look at Bucks, which is a leading brokerage and also crypto exchange in Amsterdam. Yorick and the team are doing some incredible stuff there. And they are now the biggest brokerage outside the States, i.e. the Robin Hood of Europe. And they offer in a really interesting package and product out to various types of users. And then you look into the UK and you look at Zumo. And they are very much offering the same, maybe a slightly different type of product, but also integrating into other layers. So listen, there's a lot happening in the space. And also outside of traditional banks, I mean, people are taking crypto payments and stuff like that. So there's chances and opportunities for guys like you and me to send out invoices and receive cryptos. I'm going to start doing that and seeing it and just test it and see how it works. And I want to see what my clients say. They might get freaked out, but it might push them down a road of investigating as to what exactly this new digital economy looks like. Because we started off the show by chatting about the metaverse and how we can leverage that metaverse, but it's also about the metaverse is about exchanging what currency. Digital currency. Right. So you got to try it, right?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, that's good insight because I don't have as much insight as you do into the European market. So I'm happy to know that there's a vested interest both from the citizens and from, or like the consumers and from the traditional banks. So that's good.
Cool. Okay. And listen, as we wrap up today's show, how can folks that are listening, how can they get in touch with you and if they want to?
I would say the best way to contact me would be through my Instagram. My Instagram is IAMKCOlson.
Yeah.
IAMKCOlson. Everything that I do, I post on there. Yeah. Everything that I'm promoting, I post on there. Feel free to DM me. I'm hiring. So if anyone's interested in learning more about my company and the way that I think about things, I post a lot of writing on my stories as well. So I would say my Instagram. Go to my Instagram.
Cool. So we include that in the show notes. So don't worry, everyone that's listening, it's in the show notes. Take a look at that, jot it down and get in touch with Casey if you want to learn more. And, you know, as we clock off on today's show, I'll say one last thing. There's a world of opportunity out there if you start looking at different ways of scaling your business. We've chatted about the metaverse today. We've also chatted about other things inside financial services that allow you to start exchanging in the digital currency. So take a look at it and get familiar with it. So this is where we're going. So it's been a really interesting episode. Lastly, as you all know, my book is just about to come out. It's called Unlocking Hidden Profit Zones. If you want a copy, drop me a note at richard@scaleupconsulting.co. I'll be happy to send you over a free copy. So drop me a note today. And looking forward to the next episode and you all tuning in.